Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You know, Murph, you know what I'm going to do for this one? We're going to do the intro with the Narcos music that we use for other stuff. You know why we're going to do that?
We've got a special guest on today.
Well, no, thank you very much. You know, no, it's not about me. It's about our actual guest.
Yeah, you're right. It's not about you.
Not about me. Wait, hey, look, man, this is all about you, baby. Tee this thing up for us.
All right. So we've been teasing you guys for quite some time now. We did this interview a couple months ago. We've been holding it for special time and a brand new year. We feel like this is the right place to start it. So if you've seen the Narcos series, of course, they didn't let Javier and I play ourselves because we would have really botched it up and nobody really would have watched it. But the person that played Javier was
Murph. Pedro. It just would have been 20 hours a day of paperwork.
You know? Oh, geez. I know. If people knew the truth.
If we didn't have to do paperwork, we could have caught Pablo in like a month.
Oh, geez. Isn't that the truth? That's, you know, at one point we talked about changing it from the Drug Enforcement Administration to the Drug Administration Administration because of all the paperwork. But today's guest is the actor Boyd Holbrook that played Murphy in Narcos. Real excited to get this on here. This is something we've worked on for well over a year. But getting on his schedule and catching him at home when we could take a couple hours of his time. But finally got him here. So just real honored to have Boyd on. I think you guys will be surprised by some of the things you hear from him. But I'm excited. I'm real excited about this
one. He's a hoot. Now, one of the reasons we held on to this, and you'll hear a little bit in there, the time we recorded this, the actor strike was in full force. Mm-hmm. So we were concerned, you know, and I don't think he was, but we didn't want to put him in a bad position. You know, they weren't allowed to promote anything. He couldn't promote his movie, Dial of Destiny. He could talk about what he was doing with Samuel L. Jackson because that was an independent. That was one of the things not covered under the mm-hmm. strike. But we wanted to wait till things were just like fully resolved. And we said, hey, yeah, you know what? Let's kick off the new year with an interview.
And you know what? Some of you know that Javier and I, we got a last-minute invitation to go to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, and speak at the International Book Fair over there. And at one point, it looked like Boyd was going to join us, which would have been really exciting because I haven't seen him. Gosh, I haven't seen him in years now. I mean, we stay in touch on the phone and texting and different ways like that. But it just would have really been exciting to be over there with him and hanging out. But last minute, the movie he's working now with Samuel L. Jackson. Now that the strike's over, they had to go back to work, and I think that probably trumped him joining us over there. But he sent you and I a picture. Oh my gosh! What people will do to get into that role, he has really sacrificed. And I mean, it's shocking. It's real shocking.
Well, it's the same thing you'll hear him talk about in the episode about what he did to get this role. He wanted to dive into it. He really wanted this role. But you know what? So we've kind of teed it up. We normally tell you who we brought on at the last before we get into the episode, but we wanted to do that right up front because we wanted anybody who's listening for the first time to hear, hey, we got a real, you know, movie star on here, mm-hmm. a guy who's just super nice, humble, kind. I worked with him the day before we got on because he had just gotten a bunch of podcast equipment and he had a bunch of wires. So we figured it out. We got him up and running while he was in the middle of tearing up his house.
Oh my gosh. I hope he got it finished before Mama got home.
Oh boy. And I'll tell you, hey, but God bless him. You're going to hear about his background. How was he able to do that? Well, that's part of his background. But Murph, hey, let's put a pin in that. We're going to get into the episode in just a little bit, but first, guys, we've got to run through our housekeeping here real mm-hmm. quick. Head on over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars. Let people know what you think of this. Let them know what you think of this episode. I know you are going to enjoy this. There's just absolutely no doubt. So go on over there, hit those 5 stars. Let us know what you think about the episode. Also, head on over to the website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. Some pictures that you will not see anywhere else other than
never been released.
Never been released. of Boyd and Pedro in training for the movie. And Murph, I don't know if is one of those pictures the infamous house.
I don't know if I sent you one of those or not. I
want the picture of him with that look on his face where it's like, oh shit.
Oh no, I don't have that. He was at one point they were learning how to raid houses. And so they had to suit up in their, you know, bulletproof vest and their web gear and all that stuff.
Oh, no. I was thinking of the other one. And well, we don't want to give it away. I'm talking about the instructions that you do not violate. So that one. Okay.
Yeah, no, we don't have that. I don't have that one.
All right. Well, look, you're going to see pictures you've never seen before. So head on over there. Also, follow us on that thing they call social media at Game of Crimes on Twitter, Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. But look, folks, hey, man, go and join us. In fact, join us at patreon.com/Game of Crimes. The first Patreon series we put out were 12 episodes going in depth on Narcos from Murphy and JP, stuff you will not hear from anywhere else. In fact, we learned stuff as we went through this, and this is the most in-depth interview ever given about the series, the book, you know, and the real capture of Pablo. So head on over there. Plus, we got season 3 with Chris Feistel and Dave Mitchell when they took down the Cali cartel. So that was 16 episodes, and you got to listen to the end of episode 12 because Chris has taken one for the team.
He was ready to, wasn't he?
I don't know. Maybe they did, and they just didn't say anything. We don't know. We're not going to speculate. But
the sacrifices that you're willing to make.
Sacrifices. And guys, we put out stuff like 911, what's your emergency? We had some real dumbass ones this last time. We did some funny ones. And if you ever want to know if people are serious about their chicken McNuggets, you just got to listen to the call. Listen to the call. Right. So head on over there. Plus, we got our Q&A coming up, the Narcometer. Murphy has redeemed himself. So I think you are now off a double secret and off a secret probation, just simply on probation.
Yeah. This will get me off completely.
This one, okay.
I'll be in the clear, everybody. I'll be free at last.
All right. So, and do that, folks. And also, hey, and just remember, folks, this is a show about crime. We talk about bad people doing bad things and bad people doing bad things to good people. We take the story seriously, but
you folks know we don't take ourselves serious at all. We're here to have some fun. We tell serious stories. We bring on some serious guests, but we're going to be the idiots here.
Yeah, and one of the ways we have fun, you got to head on over to our Game of Crimes fan page run by our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, rules with the iron fist with the velvet glove. Just go over to Game of Crimes or go to Facebook and type in Game of Crimes fans. Just answer a couple questions, get admittance into the inner sanctum so that you engage in the hilarity, jocularity that ensues anytime that we put out an episode.
It's those people are a hoot. I mean, you just got to check it out. Go check it out. Not only do they put funny stories on there, they give us ideas on who we could bring on the show. But we know what? When people are having a little bit of an issue, these guys got each other's backs. They come to bat for each other. I love that. I love that fan club.
Yes, they do. And you know what else? We get a lot of our stories for like the next segment coming up because we put them into this little thing. You know what time it is, Murph? I know you know what time it is. Guess what time it is?
What time is it?
It's time for Small Town Police Spotter. You know, we should. I'm gonna have to do the intro with the we're gonna do the Narcos music instead of our usual police siren on this one. You know why? Because all of these stories have a Kentucky nexus to them.
There you go.
So,
and who's from Kentucky?
You are.
Boyd Holbrook.
No, he's not.
Yeah, he is.
I'm just kidding. I know that.
I'm from Tennessee and West Virginia.
Yeah, but y'all got family down there, and we'll talk about the Hatfield and the McCoys in the episode. But hey, guys, guess what, Murph?
Yeah.
Kentucky State Police received a call Tuesday morning, reported that an intoxicated man was operating their definition of a motor vehicle in the town of Betsy Lane, population 688.
Salute.
The investigators made contact with the suspect, Michael Kimmel, no relation to Jimmy Kimmel. But he fled on foot. He fled on foot. And you know what he left behind? He left behind his ride. And you know what his ride was?
Oh, I don't even want to venture a guess.
It was a horse. He left behind a horse, which makes perfect sense since he was eventually corralled and charged with DUI. You know what his alias is? Alias is Mike Bicycle. You know why they call him Mike Bicycle? Because he's had his license probably revoked 50 times. And can't drive anything but a bike.
I'm trying to find out where this place is, but it's so remote. I can't even find it on the Google Maps.
Betsy Lane, L-A-Y-N-E, Betsy Lane. All right, hey, Murph, you know who George Howard is?
George Howard. I don't think so.
I know. That doesn't matter because he's the subject of our next story. So he was arrested early in the morning after police spotted his 2006 Ford swerving across the road into Louisville. Not Louisville, people. Louisville. Mm-hmm. Louisville suburb. Mm-hmm. At one point, the vehicle collided with the curb, almost causing an accident. When it did, a head popped up out of his lap. Cops say Howard, 59, was having difficulty controlling the auto because he hit the trifecta, folks. He was driving, drinking a beer, and getting oral sex from his 53-year-old female passenger.
Oh, God.
And when they approached, they said, "What are you doing?" She says, "We were just talking." And the officer says, allegedly, "Hey, next time, don't speak so close to the microphone."
Ba-doop-boop.
I've been waiting to use that
one. How is it that we know how to say Louisville? Our first guest of last year,
yep,
of 2023, was John Mattingly.
And the real story of Breonna Taylor. So you got to go listen to that one. So, Murph, it's going to shock you. You know, the legal limit's 0.08. Mm-hmm. He was twice the legal limit. So he went to jail.
I wonder how old he was.
He's 59. She's 53. But Howard's companion, who was not arrested, tried to hide a beer under her dress as the police approached. So when Howard exited the car, his pants fell to the ground.
And what fell out of her dress?
A beer.
A bear.
Better than something else.
All right. Now, Murph, this next one, though. If you want, you type in Florida man, you got to type in Kentucky man. You're going to get stories like this. So a Kentucky man was arrested Tuesday after police said he drunkenly found a way into a stranger's apartment. Now, this happened at 1:45 p.m. in the afternoon. This isn't like 1:45 a.m. 1:45 p.m.
Okay.
In Elizabethtown. Elizabethtown, population 31,938.
Salute.
He entered the residence on Robina Court, sat down on a couch where a woman was sleeping, moved the woman's feet so he could sit down, and when she woke up, he told her, "I'm armed and horny."
Well, there's something you don't hear every day.
You know, I've heard of armed and dangerous. I have never put out a bolo for somebody who was armed and horny.
Well, what was he armed with? Was it a single shot or?
A snub-nosed revolver, apparently. Apparently it was a 2-inch single shot flesh repeater.
Oh, did she laugh?
Well, the case was thrown out of court, lack of evidence. So, no, I'm taking it back. The evidence wouldn't stand up in court.
Oh,
these
Lord,
are getting,
it's getting
anyway,
worse. It's getting worse.
This is going to shock you. He was drunk. He smelled strongly of alcohol, slurred his speech, and was very unsteady on his feet. When they interviewed him, he said he knew the woman was unable to tell the officer her name. At one point, he said, "I kept trying to get her name, but she wouldn't give it to me."
Good grief. Okay. She wasn't in that car earlier, was she?
I don't think so. No. This guy, I'm armed and horny. All right, well, look, we've already teed this up. So the best thing we can do now as we close out Small Town Police Blotter, so all these stories were Kentucky in honor of our guest, Boyd Holbrook, actor extraordinaire, played Murph extraordinaire. So, Murph, what do you say? You ready to get into it and play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Boyd Holbrook Special Edition Game of Crimes?
Hey, everybody, I am so honored to have Boyd Holbrook on here. This is a true gift that he's given to us. So get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. Come on, Boyd, tell us the true stories now.
Well, amigos, players, playerettes, dudettes, everybody in between, this is a momentous occasion. This has been a long journey. We have had to employ the U.S. Marshals, trackers, SEAL Team 6, to track this dude down. And Murph, I'm going to let you talk about it. I'm going to let you do the intro because I feel sorry for the guy. His house has been totally torn apart. He's out of work, no unemployment checks. I think we need to start a GoFundMe page for him.
Well, you know what I ended up doing? I had to call his mom. He made the mistake of introducing me to his mom a few years ago in California. And when all else fails, call mom. She will tune you up. Now, this is, I can't tell you how excited I am. And I'm not doing it just because this young man is here on the screen with us as we're doing an interview today, but just honored as to what has transpired from the Escobar investigation. The last thing we ever thought would happen in our lives was there would be a show depicting the takedown of Pablo Escobar. And I was fortunate enough to meet an actor who, as it turns out, you know, I think we've got some familial lines going back because of where he's from and where I grew up. But it is a true honor to welcome the actor, the famous, the infamous Boyd Holbrook onto today's show, man. Boyd, welcome, brother.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. Thank you very much. What a nice introduction.
And you can tell
like
he's doing his He's doing his sexy voice today, so...
I'm up close and personal with this microphone.
Hey, well, we did start a GoFundMe page, Bucks for Boyd. So if you guys want to just go there and help out, you know, we found out yesterday, no unemployment checks. I mean, you're out of work, right? It's hard life.
I am currently out of work, but I am staying the course. My organization is on the picket line right now, but you kind of have to keep prepping. I got some films have been, you know, moved around and stuff like that. And so I think we might get a waiver to shoot. So we'll shoot in maybe November. Yeah, because we're not like it's an independent film. So it's not a studio thing. So some of these films can get waivers. And I'm sure I'm hoping we get that waiver because I started prepping for this job out in March. It's a film called Last Meals. With Samuel Jackson, where I play a prisoner on a hunger strike. So, we're on the picket line, but doesn't really. I can't really stop prepping what I'm doing right now because
you're on a hunger strike technically, right?
I'm technically on a self-induced hunger strike. How bizarre and backwards that may be. But you know, I can't really.
Well, you can't balloon back up and have to do it all over again.
Yeah. So we started this thing in March. We're supposed to shoot in May and it just got pushed. And then with the strike, it's been pushed further. So, it's mentally pretty challenging.
Well, how do you prepare for something like that? Do you have there's always coaches for like voice coach or acting coach. Do you have somebody work with you on, you know, because you got to maintain your energy because, dude, you got your house torn apart. You got to put that thing back together.
Yeah. I've got a really good insulated team. I always work with the same guy rehearsing, Terry Knickerbocker, studied underneath him at school. And then I'll have voice coaches or, you know, whatever it may take to do the job. But right now, I'm just trying to do something. I saw this show Alone, and that gave me the idea. It's like, okay, if I'm not going to eat, I have to have some crazy endurance physical job so I can just keep burning calories. And so I decided to sand the floors of my entire house while my wife was gone. So. This will be a nice surprise. Hopefully she'll see the floor before the podcast.
Well, that was kind of funny because we've scheduled a couple of interviews with you and you'll send us a picture of what your house looks like. And it's like, oh my God, it looks like a bomb went off in there.
Yeah.
And now it makes sense because Mama's going to be home at the end of the month and you got to get that shit straightened out.
I got to get it done.
You're done.
Hey, well, let's talk. As we do with all of our guests, we always want to start off with Cosa Nostra, thing of ours. So a lot of them, how'd you get started in law enforcement? But you, how did you get started in this thing? Because you come from Prestonburg, Kentucky. By the way, population 3,681. Salute. So how'd you get started, man?
I used to watch the Russell Simmons Deaf Poetry Jam when I was a kid. And maybe when people say they want to be doctors and they just, I want to be a doctor. I just saw these guys perform and, that's what I'm going to do with my life. I want to express that. I want to feel that. I want to, have that charge. And then it took me another 10 years to get to New York and to get into school and start training and studying. And,
had an opportunity. You got, as they say, you got discovered, right? Though. So it wasn't, I mean, you were doing carpentry and somebody did, you were a freaking male model.
I was, believe it or not. I don't know. I've told many people that they might believe. Well, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things. But yeah, I was working at a theater company. I dropped out of college. I met Michael Shannon, and he was the one actor I'd met, and he recommended I get into the theater. So I got into a theater company. My sister knew the lighting director. So I started building sets and running sound design, and that's where I really just found my tribe. I was like, oh, these are the people that I can, that I'm going to, you know, spend my life with. And then, yeah, lucky, I don't know if it was luck or not, cause it was a weird, job vocation. But a lady came by and said, hey, you know, you should do some modeling for these companies. And I didn't really know what it meant at the time. But I said, yeah, sure. You can take my picture. And then a couple months later, this company out of New York called me and said, we got a job for you. And I, again, luck would have it, I had a cousin out in Hoboken, and she let me stay on her couch for a month. And I took that money and got an apartment and got a job at the coffee shop in Union Square, and just kept crawling and scratching.
So, you know, a lot of people, when you hear their stories, their origin stories, it's like, I went out to Hollywood, I went to LA. I mean, you're on the exact opposite coast. What kind of opportunities? Was it just the modeling stuff? Because I know you did some stuff with art. I mean, you've got some stuff you've done with art and sculpting. So what was it about New York that attracted you versus going out to Hollywood?
Well, I knew I wanted to be an artist. I didn't really understand fully what that meant or what, you know, angle and what medium I was going to do. You know, I'd been in some like talented and gifted classes for drawing as a kid, but, you know, a lot of people are as well. And so I always had that fascination and interest. And then I got to New York and I got a camera. I started going to art galleries. I saw an artist there, and I just called him up and I said, you know, hey, I'd love to work for you. And he was surprised about that because I basically wanted to work for free. And, you know, he taught me mold making, and then, I ended up getting a gallery show about a year later, and then getting into a group show. And with, I think one of the group shows was me going down and documenting, all the coal mining there in Eastern Kentucky, and
oh, really?
Making some, yeah, doing some photography with the miners. And then,
did your family have a mining background, or you have any family in the coal business?
Yeah, my dad ran a D11, for anybody who knows how big those dozers are, on a surface mining operation there in Eastern Kentucky. So Eastern Kentucky used to be America's energy capital of America in the 80s and 90s, and it was a great job. And so my dad's done that, and he's retired now.
You know, any effects from the coal? I'm sorry, Murph, go ahead.
I think we compared notes one time, and Connie's family is all coal miners, her dad and both brothers. And I think her oldest brother was a superintendent at one of the mines there adjacent to where your dad worked. I think they may not have known each other personally, but they knew of each other. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know,
very close knit.
Yeah, and if this is all leading to an incestuous relationship that, you know,
hey, well, no, keep me out
probably
of
intersect.
Well, we do have some things in common. By the way, actually, you know what? All three of us have things in common. And we'll get into narcos, but we've all been in Bogota, Colombia.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We've all got a connection to narcos. Mm-hmm. We've all been trained to at least some extent, right, by DEA, right? And we've all been told not go in the house.
You know about that story, is that right?
Well, that's a setup, right?
Two of us listened.
That was a setup.
Yeah, that was. I walked right into that one, didn't I? Oh man!
But it's nice to see you laugh about it.
I had the great idea of I was like, well, if we're going to play these DEA agents, maybe we should just go to Quantico, train for a week or two. I thought that was a great idea at the time. And I got Pedro involved in it, and Steve and Javier pulled some strings, and I think they were the first civilians to ever go into the DEA and you know, get out there and walk through the actual training.
As far as I know, and I'll be honest with you, it would not happen today. It was the reason it happened was because the administrator at the time was Michelle Linhart. And she knew, you know, she knew this is going to be a big time show. We thought we didn't think anybody's going to watch the show. But it was because of her and Tommy Harrigan, who was deputy administrator, they made it all happen.
Now, had you known Pedro prior to that, or was that your first time working with him?
The first time working with him. Yeah. First time. We went out, had dinner together one night, and I laid it on him. I said, "Hey, I think I got us into the DEA, man. Want to go?"
What did he start shaking then, or what?
Everything sounds great on paper, you know.
Well, let's walk backwards a little bit and talk about getting into that, because you obviously got into acting. You did a few things like the Hatfields and McCoys. You were Cap Hatfield. I thought it was pretty cool too. Some of the stuff you did, like Logan. It's some neat stuff. The Marvel stuff, you know, that's such a franchise, you know. But so walk us through, how does it come about that you are asked, to read for the part, or did you have the fix was in, or did you compete against other people? How did this whole thing about Narcos end up on your desk?
So, I had a casting director call me who I'd worked with previously. And, she said, "I'm casting the show Narcos. And, it's about, to take down a Pablo Escobar. You want to go in and meet these guys?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely." I just finished working on a sculpture piece from the artist I was working on, and he went down to Colombia in Brazil and, basically acquired a bunch of coke and made a cocaine sculpture out of a Colombian farmer. And, it was more of a, conceptual, eyebrow raiser. But as you know, in correlation to show, what the products come out of there and speaking through that medium of sculpture. So we'd finished that and we'd, researched the hell out of Colombia. So we'd found out all about, the drug trafficking there. And then a couple months later, this comes up. And so I get into the meeting and I know a lot about Colombia. So we just start talking all about Colombia, and I find out that, why am I here? They want me to play this guy named Steve Murphy.
It's because you both were hillbillies from Kentucky, or,
that's
that area.
Right. It's like, wait a second. He's a hillbilly, and so am I. Wow. I think I might be able to pull that off.
There you go.
Hey, well, real quickly, too, how much did you know, though, about Pablo Escobar prior to this? Was that part of your research on the statue, or how much were you aware of that?
Not a ton, I knew that he was an iconic, infamous drug dealer, but didn't really know the extent of his background and just really the overall international global impact that he had. That wasn't until, that's the great thing about being an actor. You get to dive in and be a micro anthropologist about all these things. Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's interesting too, because, you hear actors talk about stuff. They talk about expanding their roles. They want to do something different. It's like Justified. You kind of played a really weird ass dude. I'm glad you don't have those crazy eyes for this interview. But what was appealing about this other than just the role? Was there something about getting into the law enforcement side or doing, like the narco trafficking side? What was it that really struck a chord with you that says, yeah, this is a role I want to do?
Well, it was a two-part. Really, I knew that Jose Padilla was going to be directing this, and also that this was, this was a really well-known story, so it was already going to have a lot of eyeballs on it. And then with the sort of creative direction that Jose was going to do, after seeing his movies, this guy's a prolific filmmaker, so I felt like I was working above, my pay grade there. I thought I was getting an opportunity, and I definitely was.
Jose treated Javier and I like kings. He was so nice, so easy to talk to, so supportive. But man, he pissed off a lot of people in Hollywood.
Well, yeah, he's not a guy that's you're going to hire him and tell him what to do. You hire him for his creative vision. And, Narcos is a pretty prolific show. There's nothing like it. It was especially at the time.
Well, I saw pictures where the staff, so Eric Newman, Jose, some other folks went and met with the president of Colombia. Typically, yeah. I mean, when I was in the government, you always had a suit on for meetings like that. And they went in, and I think, you know, they had like open collared shirts and sport coats, and so did the president. But there was Jose in a t-shirt and a skull cap.
Yeah, he didn't.
That's Jose.
He didn't care.
Yeah. That wasn't a big deal to him.
So, and tell everybody, give us kind of the inside baseball thing. So, like, from the first time you're approached by the casting director till you actually sign a contract, you say, I'm the guy that's in. What does that process look like? How long does it take? And was anybody else competing for the part two, or was it you?
Yeah, I think there was another a couple bigger names, if you, that's how you want to, let's say it, that were sort of that they were approaching. I think, you know, it's probably a three, you know, it's probably 6 months from when we started, you know, hey, meet these guys. There is the possibility of shooting the show called Narcos to actually going into production. So maybe 6 months to maybe 9 months before we actually started, you know, the interviewing, auditioning process to, you know, hey, you got the job. I think that took a couple months. I met with everybody, Eric Newman and Jose and Chris Brancato, who's one of the main writers there, which it really helped me. You know, it helped me that I was from the same area, you know, had similar dialect and stuff like that. And I think I'd just done a film called Little Accidents about a coal miner who had survived a cave-in, and it was regionally, you know, same place where Steve is from. And so that definitely leaned into my favor.
Nice. Well, the thing that would have cut you from the role, I think, is you had more hair than Murph. I mean, how did they handle that?
Well, Steve's going to love this part. I shaved a receding hairline into my head.
You can't. Did you really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, that was God.
In the off season, that was an interesting look in between season one and season two.
Here's something you didn't know, Murph.
Yeah, this is educational. You know, one of the other things.
I'll do anything for the role, you know.
There you go. Well, you're starving yourself right now. Holy cow, that's commitment, I got to say.
Well, part of it's because he doesn't have income coming in. So, you know, we got to cut back on the food as well to make the dollar stretch.
Yeah. The whole goal is not eat cat food, right?
That's right.
it's amazing what you folks are willing to go through. The professionalism associated with your craft there. It's you do things that, you know, people think we do crazy things. Well, I think you do crazy things, but that's what makes the world go around, right?
Well, I knew that it was just, I had to give everything or lay it all on the line, however you want to put it, to, you know, I was kind of a no name. At the time, maybe still am, but
hardly.
You know, I felt like I needed to. I just was ready to do anything to make that a great project.
Yeah, it was. It was a blast. It was just for us, it's an experience of a lifetime.
Yeah, I mean, I was the only actor that didn't leave. We were there for 9 months.
So you stayed in you stayed in Columbia the whole time.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, I think. The producers or showrunners, there was two of them, and then they would stay for 2 weeks and then they'd switch out, go back to Los Angeles and come down to Columbia. But, we got to stay the whole time. We got that treat.
Well, yeah, and think about this, Morgan, here was a challenge because, you know, I don't know who the big names you were talking about that you were competing against. I know at one point they mentioned, to us. And I don't know if they were doing this out of courtesy or just to you know, put a smile on our face, whatever. They said, you know, they're considering Jake Gyllenhaal. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was talking to Chris Brancato at the time, and several weeks went by, and I went back to Chris and I said, hey, man, you know, I didn't know who these actors are. I don't know actors. And I said, I looked that guy up. He's pretty big. And he's like, yeah, his agent turned it down. And I'm like, well, how come? And he said, well, you got to understand, Steve. He said, you know, he gets $5 million to make a movie that's filmed in less than 3 months. We're asking him to commit to 2 years to 20 episodes, and we don't have that kind of budget to pay. So yeah.
That's absolutely the reason why I got one of the opportunities. I mean, there's people and it's like, there's tiers, you know, I say Jake's in that top tier and probably below it, but, you know, to uproot your life and to move to, you know, Columbia is incredibly gorgeous culture and a place to be, but you know, it's third world in some places, and it's, you know, you ain't got internet connection to talk to your family, and it's, you know, it's rough going there for, so it was a lot to do. And to someone of, you know, let's say that caliber to do it. But that's how people get opportunities, man. People pass on stuff.
So how did, you know, because Pedro Pascal just came out of, you know, he was in Game of Thrones, you know, he's got a, you know, huge name. What was the pull between, you think, him getting into that role? Because, you know, he obviously had a big name at that time. He was well known. But to get two of you guys, of your caliber, to commit to 9 months, there had to be something obviously it's not just the pay. It's like, but the excitement of being down there and being a, you know, in a sense, a part of history.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Pedro just, yeah, like you said, come off the Game of Thrones. So he had that little, you know, push. But I think John Ortiz was the name that they were floating around. And, you know, I don't know how he weaseled his way in there, but he sure did. And we're like a little pack of brothers after, you know, a couple months of shooting.
Well, hey, now tell us about, you said you had to be interviewed and then you auditioned. What is that like when you're going in for something like this? Who does the interview? Who does the audition? What did you have to do to prepare for that? The reason I'm fascinated by this, I think other people do, they just sit down, they turn on Netflix, they watch Narcos, and they go, oh, there's Boyd, there's Pedro. You know, we see the story, without realizing for that 45 minutes or whatever it is, how much work goes into it beforehand. So what's the intro and audition like for somebody like you? Because at this point in time, you've got about, what, a good 10 years into the business now?
Yeah, I think I was 32 or 31 when we started shooting. And I got out of drama school when I was 28. So I really started working when I was like, you know, 29, 30, I started booking a couple of films and this and that. So, you know, I was still fresh, but, you know, you meet with these guys, they want to see if, you know, they just probably poking the bear a little bit. Is this guy confident enough to be able to handle this? What's, you know, they're asking you all kinds of questions. To see what your lifestyle is like, how dedicated you are, you know, just kind of getting a vibe, because you are going to be in the trenches with these people for 2 years. And
did you know at the time it was going to be two seasons?
I heard 2 to 3. And I negotiated a 2-year contract because of, you know, when me and Wagner Mora both you know, had the same contract, because I didn't really, I wanted to play it as Steve did. You know, he was down there for the amount of time he was down there. And then once Pablo was taken care of, you got back to your life. And I think, you know, in reality, Javier did, you know, maybe kind of transition out a little bit more, and that's kind of how they played it with Pedro a little bit too. So, yeah, we kind of stayed to script on that.
Yeah. What we say is that the timeline is pretty accurate. And what you see in seasons 1 and 2, about a third of it's true, a third of it's kind of true, and a third of it is, man, that came right out of the Hollywood writer's room. And which, there were fantastic writers on the show. I loved them all. They were all so nice to us.
Well, we do a Patreon channel, and so for the last two, what we call our narcometer, we do the narcometer review, rate things on a scale of 1 to 10 kilos for accuracy, authenticity, and believability. We did seasons 1 and 2 of Narcos right before, yeah, in honor of you finally coming on after 18 months, we had to track you down, you know.
Call mom.
Call mom. Actually, it was Jonathan Bernthal. We sent him, yeah. He sent you the middle finger from our gang conference in Southern California.
Yeah. He's piece of work. He's a good guy.
That John's great.
Hey, so let's get into you. When you finally get notice of it, how do you now start preparing for the role of Steve Murphy? Because at some point you got to meet the guys, you know, you got to start understanding DEA and tactics. So how does that work out?
Well, I'm just trying to figure out what's the theme of the character, from you know, the theme of the character is kind of a fish out of water. You know, you've got this gringo down there who's doesn't really speak the language. You know, it's part of his journey is, you know, learning that, you know, engulfing himself in the culture, adopting two children, you know, it's pretty deep. So looking at it from that angle, so the guy's not, he's a fish out of water. He's navigating this really unfamiliar land that he's trying to work through. And then there's the physicalization of the character that I always like to start with. You know, I grew up in Eastern Kentucky, so I've got a pretty twangy accent. But at the, you know, beginning of my career, I understood that, you know, I'm only going to be able to play a handful of characters here. So I got into voice and speech, and now I can do, you know, Australian, Brooklyn.
Hear Australian.
Appalachia.
Let's hear.
If I was from Wagga Wagga.
Wagga Wagga. That's right, mate. G'day.
Pretty good, man.
Yeah, give me a script and I can turn it into something. But so I usually start with where the character's from. So, you know, that dialect was easy for me, and the voiceover is a very big component to that. So just figuring out the voice of the character, and then I need to know, okay, well, I'm never going to have the amount of training that Steve Murphy's had, but I need to do something to give me the illusion of confidence that, you know, I've dabbled in it at least, rather than being a complete unknown. And that's where it comes in. I call up Steve with the big idea saying, hey, maybe, is it possible to get into Quantico?
What did you take, Murph, when you heard that the first time, going, this civilian wants to get into, that an actor wants to get into Quantico?
Well, you know, I mean, the first of all, that an actor's calling you, somebody that's, you know, it's a true Hollywood actor. It's like, shit, I don't know any of these people. But it was it was a fantastic idea, you know, and that's when I reached out to Javier, ran it by him. He's good with it. Talked to, I think I called probably Eric next, who's Eric Newman is the creator of the Narcos series. He's the executive producer. And he was all in favor of it. And I'm like, well, you know, you got to get somebody to pay for it, Eric. And he's like, I'll take care of you. You take care of DEA. I'll take care of the money. And we ended up talking to, I think, and originally to Tommy Harrigan, who was deputy administrator. And he took it to Michelle, who was administrator. And it was no time until the approval came down. And it was more so than what we thought it was going to be. They said, you know, they said, what is it you want to do? And we said, well, you know, we'd like to bring them to headquarters and let them get some briefings from some of the old intel analysts that are still on the job and get that perspective. And we'll talk to them. And then we'd like to take them to the DEA Academy. And that led to being embedded with an ongoing DEA Academy class for a week, which, you know, that was pretty cool.
Oh, it was incredible. It was fantastic. It was amazing.
Talk about going into that. What were you thinking? What did you, you know, what was your paradigm shift? What did you think it was from watching TV versus what did you discover from reality that changed how you're going to do the role?
Well, you kind of have this naive bliss that this is just going to be great and fun and an experience. But we got into it. We met up with Javier and Steve down in Virginia there. And we've, you know, got clearance, got name tags, and we go through the gates, and it's 30,000 acre complex or something like that. So it's enormous. I mean, there's well, I was just initially, you know, taken back by these little ghost towns that they've created where they can do all these, you know, these exercises at, where there's, you know, cars where you can, they taught us how to run a car off the road. And they've got motel rooms where you can do buys and deals with, and
And houses. And
that's where it started to change, get a little interesting. And they took us to some houses and some deals, and they have all these scenarios and I guess instructions of what to do and what not to do.
And
so we're in Hogan's Alley is where we are.
We're in Hogan's Alley. And the first one we were in a hotel room, and they want you to buy a half a kilo of something, the booger sugar, as people call it, cowboy dust. And we pull up, you know, you're in a car, you're with another agent, you pull up to this, makeshift apartment, roadside motel looking thing, and go inside, and the guy's there, and I'm like, this is great, man. This is just like a little improv class. I can do this. I can bullshit with the best of them. And that went pretty well. So that gave me a fair amount of confidence. And then, Pedro does the same, and we're comparing notes, and did you get it? Yeah, I bought it. Yeah, I did that. And then they want us to take us to another operation, and they give you this piece of paper that says, whatever you do, I thought it said, don't leave. And, they go pull up to the house. Guy meets me at the door immediately. Hey, how you doing? Yeah. You want to come in? Sure. I'd love to come in. First mistake, get inside the house. And the guy's like, so remind me where I know you. I was like, oh, we met through Tammy. And Tammy, I was like, oh man, I'm going to have to start spitballing here. Tammy's, we met her at the strip club and just hanging out. And then this other third person comes through the back bedroom, and it took me off guard immediately. He had to come in with a little fire in his belly.
He had a big attitude, man.
Yeah, big attitude. Who's this guy? Why'd you let this guy in the house? I was like, take it easy, man. We're just playing make believe here, buddy. Just take it easy. And he goes, stand up. And before they go in, they give you this, you know, it's basically a dry fire gun. It makes, without bullets, it's blanks. And he asked me to stand up and turn around, and he pulls that gun out of the back of my waistband. And things then got real serious. And, I know that there's DEA in the background kind of observing all this happening, but I'm starting to actually kind of fear for my life here. And I'm like, is this joking? Are we serious here, guys? And he tells me to shut up, and he's screaming at me, sit the F down, and this and that. And I'm like, gosh. And then he goes around me with my gun he's taken off me, and fires it off beside my head. And he goes, yeah, operation's over. You've now been killed. And it happened, in less than a minute. That's how serious it got.
And, what did you think of their acting job?
A master class, Daniel Day-Lewis. I was, it got serious real quick, and come to find out that I wasn't even supposed to go in the house, not to leave the house, but don't go in. Because Pedro, he nailed that one. He kept kind of coercing him to come in. Come on in. I was talking about this. No, not going to do that. And, but that was a rude awakening to, just how serious this job can get.
Very quickly. And that's what every trainee goes through. That wasn't scripted just specifically for you and Pedro. It's to teach the guys, you can walk away from a deal. There's none of these shit birds, and there's no amount of dope worth any good guy getting injured over. But I mean, you handled it professionally. I got to say, man, you kind of fell out on the floor there when he fired that gun. And I'm thinking, oh no, did he crap his pants? Is he okay? Do you have a heart attack? And they called administrative stop. Is what they call it. And I mean, you, you didn't let on that you were nervous. I'm kind of surprised that you were nervous because I didn't see that in you at all that day. I think you were surprised. You were shocked at the way it went. But
I just didn't know how, it was shocking how fast it went down. You know, one little move and you're outnumbered and you're in their house and you're in trouble.
Yeah. Morgan, they even made these guys sit through a 1 hour classroom session. I thought, man, we even went and sat in that. And I thought, this is still as boring now as it was when I went through the academy back in 87.
Well, they had all kinds of stuff. I remember going to like an Applebee's and they had these actors they hired out of Maryland. They had this one lady who was fantastic, but they would wire all these, you know, these young kids up who were training to be a DEA. And we would, go out into this parking lot and they'd meet up with these actors who were playing dealers and stuff like that. So we were sitting in cars, you know, parked just like they would do surveillance, you know, a couple parking lots, parking spaces away, watching all of it kind of go down, but you could hear it because they were mic'd up. You could just for studying purposes, but oh man, I mean, this is a job that you kind of have to fail at in training to be able to save your life later on. And I just remember one of these ladies just chewing this kid up, you know, just like, you know, kind of cross-referencing how they knew each other, or, you know, how legit he was. And she just tore him to pieces.
Yeah, they're checking your backstop to see if you've got the story. Oh, yeah. Are you winging it? You know, which unfortunately that's what happens more often.
I'll never forget it. She said, "Where do you live at?" She's like, "I live over here. What street? Elm Street. Elm Street. You live on Elm Street."
Well, tell me about the store there on the corner of Main and Elm. What's the name of it? You know. And yeah, that's right. You go down. Well, let me ask you, just that one little incident in the house. Yeah, we kind of did set you up. But you hit upon a very key point because we get a lot of law enforcement people listening. And it's a lot about training. But how did that one little thing of getting surprised like that help you now when you start doing this role of being Steve Murphy? You know, actually now you're in Columbia. You know, yeah. I mean, it's like, dude, I mean, this is real shit when you're down there, even though you know it's acting, but it's like, but in your role, you know that tens of thousands of people have been killed by Pablo. I mean, people are dying down there. Cops are getting shot. And now you're in this same country now.
Well, I mean, it measures you. It makes you, that one situation, it woke my ass up. It really informed me that, you know, I'm dealing with dangerous people all the time. And whatever you say can be used against you or not. You know, you've got to float that line of how, you know, an agent, how he walks that tightrope of just what to say, what to do in the right situation. You know, a lot of people kept telling me, oh, you need a bodyguard when you get down to Columbia. You know, you're out in these favelas or communas, as they call them down there. And I mean, I know it was 1 week. It was, you know, intensive week, but it was so much. I took so much from it rather than never doing it that, you know, it just kind of makes your eyes peeled of who you're dealing with, when you're dealing with them, and how measured you should be because, you know, your life is on the line in a certain way.
Had you not gone through that week of training, how much different do you think the show would have been, at least for you portraying Murphy, had you not been able to do that week of training?
I think there's an incredible amount of seriousness that settled inside me rather than just going out and like, hey, I'm going to have fun. You know, I'm an actor. I'm going to have fun shooting the show. It's, you know, it's an experience for me. That week of training put my butt on the floor. It settled me to really what's at stake here and what these guys were trying to do. So it was immensely important.
But there were a lot of fun times there too. I mean, we spent half a day on the range. I mean, these guys got to shoot weapons that I didn't even get to shoot. I remember they were brought the Tommy gun.
They didn't trust you.
That's the difference, Murph.
Yeah. They had to go through
Which way does this go? They had to go through the
don't shoot scenarios with the old FAT system, and they took them inside, taught them how to do training, raids, and clearing rooms.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, clearing rooms. We're in those empty rooms and learning how to do that.
Felony car stops. It was pretty intensive.
What was the funnest part for you down there, Boyd? That you know, when you got out of it, what was the funnest part? I mean, I know you did some serious stuff, but for you, what was fun?
I just thought, I mean, these guys are cowboys. You know, they are highly trained and, you know, cutting up with guys at that level is, it was just, as a treat, you know, there's a certain, cowboy attitude to those guys. And, you only get that out of certain guys. Like I met SEALs and there's just a certain camaraderie to that. And, just shooting the shit and hanging out with those guys, that was the best for me.
Yeah, I think I told you this, Morgan, but all four of us, Boyd, Pedro, Javier, and I stayed in a hotel, I think in Stafford's where we were outside the Marine Corps base there. And in the evenings, once class was over, you know, we'd all go back to the hotel and get something to eat and then get cigars and maybe a bottle of wine and go sit outside, just shoot the breeze and answer their questions and just small talk, getting to know each other a little bit more. And that was, I've never done that since, you know, and to have the opportunity to sit there with Boyd and Pedro like that, and, you know, we're small town country boy cops. I mean, you get to hang out with these two movie stars, you know, it was a big deal, I got to say.
Well, just remember, Prestonburg, population 3,681. He started small town. I came. My town was 1,500 people, so we're all a little small town. From yeah, you know, I'm from Kansas, so we're all that. Hey, well, let's roll forward now. Now you're doing this. Speaking of Spanish, did you know any Spanish? Did you have to pick it up? Was that part of the training for the job? I mean, how much Spanish did you end up speaking during the series?
I'd say a tenth. You know. It was kind of written into the character that this is an obstacle for him navigating this world. And for me personally, you know, I could end up getting, by or go wherever I needed to go in a cab or something like that in Spanish. That's basically extending my Spanish. And it was pretty much, you know, 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, nine months straight. There's nothing really else you can do other than just go to work, come home, eat something, crash, get up, repeat. So I wish I could have, you know, maybe.
Did you, that's what I said, with one day off, did you get a chance to go see anything, go visit some sites? I mean, you know, eat at some great places, you know, anything like that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We went to, we were pretty much stuck in Bogota the whole time, but, I found my little tribe of people there and we'd all kind of, you know, us actors, we all go out to eat and stuff like that. But, I mean, the Colombian food and culture is just, it's incredible.
Did you ever go eat at Montserrat, the restaurant on top of the hill that you take the cable car up to?
There. Yeah. I went up there a couple of times.
Well, that's what we all have in common too. We've all ate there too. So, I mean, yeah, it's beautiful. I remember I was down there, believe it or not, in 2000, Javier and I crossed paths in the embassy because I was working on Plan Colombia. And that's when he came back for his second time, which is kind of portrayed in Narcos. He hung around, but yeah, it was just so amazing down there. The culture, the people, and even the people in the government, I felt sorry for them because they were outgunned. You know, if you think about it too, the Narcos had the money, they had the organization, and these people were trying to do what they could. And that was the thing I thought you guys represented well, was just showing what the real good people of Colombia look like, because they're all not narco traffickers. They're all not bad people. There are a lot of good people in Colombia. They just, you know, literal and figurative sense, they were outgunned.
Yeah, I imagine that's what, you know, a lot of you know, people in Mexico are dealing with the cartels down there. It's, you know, it's, you can only kind of do so much and you kind of have to let a little bit of it ride or get out of the way of, or you're going to get trampled.
Yeah. You know, one credit I want to give to you and Pedro, the first night I met you guys, I picked you both up at the airport. We had you, Pedro was, if you remember, Pedro was real late coming in, his flight was delayed and, So we had you guys come over to the house for dinner, and Monica and Mandy, our daughters, so they were still in high school, maybe even middle school. No, I think they're in high school by this time. But no, I think they're in middle school. Anyway. So you guys came over, and unbeknownst to us, the girls had invited all their little friends to come over later that night. And I'm thinking, I told Connie, I'm like, you know, these are Hollywood actors. We don't know these people. I mean, they might be offended that, you know, we're taking liberties with introducing them to all these people. And we were a little nervous when all the kids showed up there, you know, and both of you guys were so gracious. You taking pictures with them, signing autographs, answering their questions. And the little boys were all standing there, and it got real quiet for a second. I was standing in the kitchen, if you remember. And I said, boys, you know who these guys are. This is your one opportunity to ask them questions. And it took about 2 seconds for one guy to look over at Pedro and goes, hey, in Game of Crimes, how did you squeeze the blood? How did they squeeze the blood out of your eyes when the mountain killed you? You know, I thought, what a question.
Oh, my God.
But both of you guys were gracious enough to spend time with him and not say.
Well, Murph, but I do want to raise one controversial issue. Pedro kind of had a reputation like JP. Uh-huh. You caught him in bed with your wife.
I did. I got photographic evidence of that shit, too. So you know about that? I hold it over her head. I remind her of that regularly.
Like a little in muddy waters there. I don't know about that.
Well, we were filming there in the apartment one day in Bogota. That one week that Connie and I and the girls came down, and Pedro was there. He was just sitting on the bed, and Connie was sitting on the other side of the bed. And I said, "Hey, you guys line up there. Let me get a picture of you together." So they laid down to bed. I'm like, yeah, "I got you now, girl."
Finally, I always knew it to be true.
So, had you ever been to Colombia before, Narcos?
No, I'd never been to South America actually, or Central.
So let's talk about getting into the filming, the seasons and stuff. So, as you started off, you know, obviously things take a while to get into rhythm, but you start getting rhythm. When do you guys think you hit your stride in terms of working together, the plot coming together? Because it's kind of, I think about like Seinfeld. You think about when Seinfeld first started, it was kind of kludgy, but then they hit their stride. You started seeing they got a great formula, great chemistry. When do you guys think that happened for you?
I would say about a good month into it. You know, Jose's got a very, you know, he does a lot of Warners. So that means like, instead of doing setups and, you know, coverage of camera here and we cut to this other camera, Warner is just like, it's probably on a steady cam from this guy named Lula, who's his DP who has shot all of his previous films. And, you know, Scorsese does a lot of those too, where it's basically choreographing movement of the actors all in one shot. So it takes a long time to choreograph it, to get it right. Maybe, you know, the blocking's not right, or you can't get the line in where the camera is moving. So it takes a long time to, this is about the same amount of time as you do, you know, using a different camera setup and blah, blah, blah. But, once we kind of figured out that style, through basically the first episode, after like, you know, getting into the second episode, like we kind of found our rhythm there.
It was very interesting to come down and watch that, you know, cause you get like in the apartment scenes, and I mean, there was one with you and Joanna and they had the baby there. And when they would film it, it wasn't unusual to do several takes because they would move the camera like behind Joanna and then they'd break and then they go move the camera behind Boyd. And it was funny, but behind every corner, every door in the closet, there were people hiding. So it looks like there's only three people in the scene, but there might be 15 people in that room. You just don't see them. You know, everybody's got to be absolutely quiet. It was kind of cool to see all that.
So you were down there for 9 months. There's like 10 episodes in one season. So how long does it take? And what's the process for filming just a single episode? It, you know, people think, hey, everything's done sequentially, but it's not always sequentially, right? You're doing things out of order and then they piece it back together later.
Yeah. So we actually started shooting the episode 8. I believe it was Jose, maybe. They do that a lot now in television. So the first episode will start around where, you know, the 8th or 7th episode. So they'll cut into that part and then they'll bring it back to the first episode. And then you'll build to that that moment that you saw that hooked you in the show. And that hook of Narcos season one was Murphy calling in the or approving the hit there of these drug dealers and these sort of Sicario guys. And so once you kind of are hooked of like, this is the main plot or what we're driving to, then it picks up at the introduction and it drives towards that eighth episode and then 9 and 10. So I'd say it's about a month at the time. I mean, they probably want to do an episode per 2 weeks, but in reality, it's probably an episode a month. And every show is different, but that's how that one was put together.
Cool stuff.
And there's continuity. There's certain things around continuity, like, you know, clothing and weapons and stuff like that. But what's it like being on set for 14 hours a day? Because, I mean, you think about just being on a regular job. It's like, man, that's a 70-hour work week. Pretty soon you start getting tired. How do you maintain, how do you maintain physically the ability to have the energy and, you know, the brain power to keep doing that stuff day after day? Because even after a month, if you're working 14-hour days, dude, I mean, your ass has got to be dragging.
Oh yeah. 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 You do. Okay. I mean, I've refined it so well that it's a marathon, and how can you get through that marathon? So I can take a nap pretty much anywhere. And it's a lot of sitting around and waiting, you know, like, of the 14 hours you're on set, you're probably working, you know, 8 to 10 of those hours, and the other time you're just waiting as they're closing one scene down, they're setting another scene up, and you'll rehearse it, and they'll, you know, go back and fix lighting, and then you have some time off there. So yeah, you just get really good at time management. A lot of rookie mistakes are going to craft service and, you know, eating sugar and, you know, muffins
and then having
and
that
whatever.
Crash later.
And yeah. And then you're like, oh yeah, I can handle this. And then about 4 o'clock rolls around and you're just dragging ass. Yeah. So you kind of trial and error of a lot.
I remember seeing down there when we came down for that week, they've got a person that walks around with a tray of candy and that's her job. She just walks around continuously and you pick candy off that tray if you want it. And then they've got a coffee barista over there. They'll fix anything you want, you know, from cappuccino, just straight black coffee or latte or whatever you want. I'm thinking, well, you people live a pretty good life here.
Oh yeah. I mean, but then that's the trick. You don't take any of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I remember there that the first of the week when we came on set, you and Joanne they were getting ready for lunch. They were going to break for lunch you know, we'd never seen this craft service where it's pretty much anything you want to eat there. And you guys are like, oh, no, no, no. We found a good restaurant. We went a few blocks away, had a good Colombian meal. You know, and I can see where I see exactly what you're talking about. Cause the other food was high carbs, high sugar.
Yeah. Yeah. I usually don't eat on any film set. I'll probably just miss dinner and I'll just go and find somewhere to take a nap, you know, and then eat a big breakfast, eat a big dinner.
Hey, well, let's talk too about as you're filming this stuff too. So, you know, my little claim to fame, I was the lead in our junior play, Harvey, Elwood P. Dowd, you know, and then I played in the Diary of Anne Frank my senior year. But there's always the issue of learning lines.
I was Mr. Von Dom. You know, he's good at that.
seeing mystical rabbits that don't appear. Hey, but how do you go about, so the other thing I'm very interested in, and hopefully other people are, is how do you go about learning your lines? At what point do you work on those things? How does that work? So like you've got a scene coming up. When does the work for that scene start? How much of it is improv versus, you know, riffing versus, you know, hey, word for word, you know, follow the script?
Well, I usually just, you know, find the accent, find the vowels, you know, and once you kind of spend a month or so figuring out, okay, well, he says A instead of A, you know, like it's pretty, you know, microscopic, but you can, you know, it makes the character. And so once you do that, you kind of set it, forget it, which was a good thing for me because at one point, there was so much rewriting done on Narcos, that I just gave up learning my lines. Because they would change it. I would get the new line. If I had lines the previous night, they were changed on the day usually. And, I just developed a technique where, over 9 months, you can give me 5 pages of dialogue and I'll have it memorized in 2 hours or maybe an hour. It's just like a muscle that you kind of train. So the whole memorization, I'm pretty sure Pedro did the same thing. We kind of had to, where you just got the pages in the morning where, you know, they're maintaining that receding hairline that I shaved in.
And I see Murphy's got to keep shaving his hair. It does grow back. Yeah, like
every morning, shave that receding hairline in, take a little bit out the back. And, I'd sit there in my chair and I would, you know, learn the lines. But you know, you know, the basic, 101 fundamentals of acting is like what the scene is about, where the beat changes and where does the scene start and where does it end? And how, what's your behavior going into that? So if you can kind of keep those things and, you know, you're shooting a scene for 3 or 4 hours, you know, by that time, you know, you have to figure it out. You have to, so that was the first time for me in my career that I went to work every single day. And there's something, so valuable to that, because as an actor, you know, say you work on 2 movies a year, you're maybe working 6 months, if that, a year. So for 9 months, I got to go to work and figure out, you know, develop a technique to learn my lines, to, you know, do all the basics. But then if a scene's not working, figure it out. Why is it not working? Well, maybe it's because of blocking. So you get that training, I guess, or that on-site job, you know, involvement that you just can't get anywhere else, that you're just like physically trial and error working it out. Okay, well, if it didn't work that way, what about if I go over here and we cut that line and we put it to the back, and then, oh, now the scene works, it just magically works. And so you just gotta be able to be confident to fail in front of people and to have the, you know, not to be too pretentious, but the courage to, you know, figure it out.
So between movies and TV shows, like you say, series, was the Hatfield and McCoys, was that a series for you? Which one was like your first series you did?
That was, yeah. That was a series that was based off of a feud that happened in basically my county, Pike County. I grew up in Floyd County, but Pike County, and then was the McCoys, and the Hatfields were on the West Virginia side. And I knew that was going to happen, and I got involved in that. And, you know, believe it or not, that was shot in Romania for 4 months because of Romania. It's, you know, again, incredibly cool and gorgeous country, but they're, you know, in the Carpathian Mountains, they were doubling for the Appalachian Mountains. You know, they're 100 years, you know, behind, which is incredible. You know, there's people in horse and cart. I don't know what it is like now, but, you know, we shot there because there's no telephone poles and there's no nothing. So that was the draw, and obviously is probably much cheaper to shoot there. But again, that, you know, thrown into the deep end and, you know, sink or swim.
Hey players, that is the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, go check us out at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, go check out our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including our book list. Any book written by our guests will be listed there. In the meantime, go check us out also, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. It's where we put a lot more content you won't hear on our regular podcast. We go into a lot more topics, and folks, it is a lot of fun. So go check us out, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. In the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.